What language do you speak? Does anyone here speak Swahili? Perhaps Urdu? Maybe Romansh? Well, Swahili, the natives are in East Africa. Urdu is spoken in Afghanistan and Pakistan. And Romansh is the fourth national language of Switzerland. Do you suppose that if we don't speak those languages, they could understand us, or could they understand each other? The challenge becomes, in speaking other languages, there is often a challenge or a difficulty in crossing the divide for understanding. Let's turn to Proverbs 1 and verse 7. And we've heard this verse from time to time in Proverbs 1 and verse 7 about increasing our understanding. In Proverbs 1, 7, the fear of the Lord is the beginning of knowledge, but fools despise wisdom and instruction. So that's a pretty good clue. Well, I don't want to be a fool, or, as the Bible might say, an immature person. I want to mature, so I'm quite interested in gaining wisdom and instruction. But it's one thing to embrace the beginning of knowledge, but on a related note, some people just resist the gaining of knowledge. We're in Proverbs 1. Let's turn to verse 22 in Proverbs 1:22. How long, you simple ones, will you love simplicity? For scorners delight in their scorning, and fools hate knowledge. Well, that sounds interesting. So people that don't want to learn anymore, they will scorn those who they don't understand or don't want to know anymore because they're confident in their own level of lack of knowledge. So we see the scorning, and we see that around in the world today. Lack of knowledge causes people to dwell on silly or even dangerous ideas. We're in the book of Proverbs. We'll go to one more in Proverbs 15 and verse 14. In Proverbs 15 and verse 14. The heart of him who has understanding seeks knowledge, but the mouth of the fools feeds on foolishness. So we have a choice. If we want understanding, we are going to seek more knowledge, a better or higher level of understanding, but the mouth of the fools, or the immature, feeds on foolishness. In other words, it's not as important to them. They will just dwell on what they think they already know. Well, I'm going to shift gears now to talk about three different languages, but it's not perhaps quite in the way we might first imagine. For many years, those in the church have twisted and agonized how to deal with the subject of politics. Those who venture verbal or written documents run the risk of offending people who have a different political mindset. Even having an opinion about political world draws condemnation from those who choose to avoid the subject of politics altogether. Well, today I'm going to wade in where it's often said that angels fear to tread, to examine how people reach their political opinions and how the basis of those political opinions correlate or clash with the Bible. Today we'll look at what the Bible says about three ways that most people react or interpret when they're faced with making a decision. So the title of this message is The Three Languages of Politics. The Three Languages of Politics. So before we pull up scriptures regarding this subject, we need to establish a working definition of politics. Now, some of us who've been around in church for a while, we often hear that commonly said that politics is a negative endeavor. And I've picked out one quote, the ungodly wrangling and strife for self-aggrandizing power. Well, this particular definition of politics is often used in church is not a dictionary definition of politics. And as a result, the common church culture has often reinforced a negative definition of politics for decades. The academic definition of politics is actually neutral. The definition we use in the classroom is simply this. Politics is the process by which people make decisions for a community. The political process is perceived as negative because of the abuse of the decision-making process. Perhaps you've heard people say, I don't get involved in politics, or that's just politics. Perhaps we've even said these things ourselves. Yet if we examine our own lives, We're involved in politics every day. In our families, we have a process by which we decide what groceries to purchase or perhaps what to grow in the garden. We have a process to decide what kind of car we drive, whether we decide to rent or purchase a home. We choose the clothes that we and our children wear. These are all political decisions. As church members, our families decide where to attend the Feast of Tabernacles, where our kids go to summer camp and other church activities to attend. When the local congregation needs to make a decision, there's a process by which that is done. When the church as a whole makes a decision, it has our employers decide whom to hire, how to produce goods and services, and how to market those goods and services. Those actually are all political decisions. As employees, we live in a highly political environment. We have to perfect our resumes or our job applications in order to get a job in the first place. Who gets promoted over whom can be a political process. Or perhaps you're an employer. The selection of vendors, the navigation of government regulations, the competition for customers to require, all of those require an astute understanding of various political processes of vendors, government bureaucrats, and customers. Politics is everywhere around us because decisions are made all day, every day. Some of those decisions are made with our input, and many of those decisions are made in the absence of our involvement. The ancient Greek philosopher Plato noted that one of the penalties for refusing to participate in politics, or you could say decision-making, is that you end up being governed by your inferiors. Who wants other people to make their decision for them? Well, politics is the decision-making process for a group of people, whether it's a small group of people or a large group. Well, there's three general philosophies about the decision-making process. Each of the decision-making philosophies appear to be hardwired in everyone. Each of these philosophies then point to the Bible as their authority for mandating that everyone must agree with them to the exclusion of the other two philosophies. We might say that these three philosophies or languages are ways of thinking that are actually hardwired into our brains from an early age. We are predisposed to think a certain way. Just as language is learned at an early age, so is our way of looking at the decision-making process. You ever tried to convince someone who had a different opinion than yourself? Most people are so locked into their way of thinking, they can't wrap their mind around any other concept or methodology. What I had discovered was absolutely true. Maybe you had that experience too. And why they should just readily see it. Here it is. I'll open up the Bible and explain it to them. And for some reason, not everyone around me saw things the way I did. And some of those, perhaps we have an awkward or embarrassing experience ourselves. Each of the three mindsets or these languages we'll look at has what we see as what one analyst called a big bad. What is the enemy or the adversary to their way of looking at life? Well, I've named or titled this message after Arnold Kling's 2013 book called The Three Languages of Politics. And he explains the major three ways people look at life and how they make the decisions. And he described these ways of making decisions like tribes that speak different languages. So, bad guy, the big bad wolf. The adversary in each of these tribes will point to the Bible to support their argument as to who's the good guy and who's the bad guy. Well, today we're going to see then what the Bible says about the three ways of thinking, and whether we admit it or not, each one of us is inclined to think in one of these three ways, or perhaps a combination of two of these ways. And the first thing we can look at is the first methodology is liberty versus coercion. Liberty versus coercion, which is point one. Some people instinctively and automatically look at almost everything in life through that lens. Does it contribute to liberty, or am I being coerced and forced to do something? And there's some reasonable backup in the Bible on this one. If we take a look at Leviticus 25 and verse 10, when we're taking a look at how God set forth a life for the children of Israel. In Leviticus 25:10, he outlined the Sabbath and the holy days earlier, and then he explained the 50th year of Jubilee in Leviticus 25:10. and you shall consecrate the 50th year and proclaim slavery throughout all the... Wait a minute. It doesn't say that. It says proclaim liberty throughout all the land to its inhabitants. It shall be a jubilee or a release, a party for you, and each of you shall return to his possession and each of you shall return to his family. So it's a tremendously joyous time. And we can do that in another explanation, but this 50th year is a year of release, and it's to proclaim liberty. And that's really a foretype of what's to come. Isaiah the prophet, in Isaiah 61, verse 1, spoke about the importance of proclaiming liberty. In Isaiah 61, and verse 1, "The Spirit of the Lord God is upon me, because the Lord has anointed me to preach good tidings to the poor. He sent me to heal the brokenhearted, to proclaim liberty to the captives, and the opening of the prison to those who are bound." If you were a prisoner, wouldn't you be pretty happy about your get-out-of-jail-free card? Feel pretty good about, you know, getting liberated, being free from something? There's a value to being liberty. And the prophet Isaiah was projecting ahead to the time of the return of Jesus Christ, when he will free us from what we are captive to today. Well, you say, well, what do you mean we're captive? We're free, we walk around. Let's take a look at John 8:34. In John 8:34, and we can see what we're captive to. In John 8:34, Jesus answered them, "Most assuredly, I say to you, whoever commits sin is a slave of sin." How'd you like to be free from being a slave? And yet we're all, to some extent, a slave to sin. So Christ said that sin is caused because we're a slave to sin. And then he goes on to say in Luke 4 and verse 18, in Luke 4 and verse 18, the words of Jesus as to why or what he is doing here on earth. What is his purpose? What is his function? In Luke 4:18, "The Spirit of the Lord is upon me, because he has anointed me to preach the gospel to the poor. He sent me to heal the brokenhearted, to proclaim liberty to the captives, and recovery of sight to the blind, to set at liberty those who are oppressed." So we can see this is a pattern. This is a pattern that was set out early in Leviticus, explaining the importance of this liberty that was to be done in the Jubilee year. It was prophesied by the prophet Isaiah about Jesus Christ coming in human form to proclaim liberty to the captives. We know that captives are captives of sin. Now, there are people that are slaves literally, and not just slaves to sin, but actual. I know that my daughter's married to a young man from Great Britain. His parents live in Great Britain. They also have a winter home in Malaysia. So, until COVID hit, they would spend their summers in Great Britain, and they're retired, and their winters in Malaysia, near the equator. Well, you can't leave your home unavailable or open all the time, so they have a house sitter in Malaysia. It's a lot cheaper to live there. And so they have a former escaped slave who is their housekeeper. In this day and modern age, slavery exists around the world. We just don't hear the same about it. Jesus Christ came to proclaim liberty to the captives, whether it be physical captive or a captive to sin. The question then, if we're looking at liberty versus coercion, and this is all under who makes decisions, we ask, well, who does make your decisions? Are you free to make your own decisions? Or is somebody coercing you to make your decisions in life, whether it's where you go, what you do, what you believe, and how you do that? I've mentioned before, as a high school teacher, I've asked students if they would like me to make their decisions for them. Just go ahead and entertain that thought. And I go on to explain, I've raised a number of successful and accomplished children. So I've experienced at making excellent decisions, and I could relieve those students from the decision-making process. They could relax. I could tell them when to get up in the morning. I could tell them what they should eat for breakfast, what clothing they'll wear for the day, how they will get to school, and when they get to school. I could decide what classes they should take, what they eat for lunch, who their friends are. I could say how much time they can spend with which friends. I can decide if they spend which particular extracurricular activities, what they do then with their leisure time, how much time is allocated for homework. By now, their jaws are pretty well dropped on the floor. And then I will pick out the foods that they can eat for snacks or supper, and then I and I alone will decide what beverages they can drink and how much of it perhaps they can consume. I will decide whether they can watch TV, and if they do, what programs can they watch. Perhaps I will look to determine what movies they can go to that may be accessible. And I will definitely set their curfew out and set limits on when they're old enough to date. I will screen whom they can date and how often and so forth, and I might even go along with them as a chaperone. Now, then I ask for volunteers. How many people are willing to let me make their decisions for them? You know, 3,000 students later, I don't have anybody who wanted me to make their decisions for them. Why is that? I've just outlined what a wonderful job I could do. I mean, I was astounded. Why don't they let me do this for them? After all, I'm a generation or two older than they are, and I've proven this decision-making, and yet what do they all want? They want to make their own decisions. They want freedom and not coercion. They don't want me or anybody else to tell them what to do, at least initially. So there is this point one about freedom versus coercion. People instinctively think it's okay to coerce others, but they themselves would rather be free. They would rather say, well, somebody else should do this, but I, of myself, want to be free. So point one is freedom versus coercion. And we can get to, there are examples on that. We'll get to that as we examine the other languages. The next political language is civilization versus barbarity. Civilization versus barbarity. Well, the concept behind this type of political language is that without a reasonable set of common rules, society would melt down. A free-for-all, lawless society would then create a miserable and even unlivable situation for many people. The law of the jungle, with survival of the fittest, would emerge. Indeed, and in reality, that's been the story of mankind for the last 6,000 years of recorded history. Throughout history, if someone wanted to gain wealth, then to the extent they were able and they were strong enough, they would simply take that wealth from other people. This hasn't just happened throughout history in the past, people taking stuff from others, but it still happens all over the world today. However, the people who respond to God's calling see things differently. God's people honor and respect the Ten Commandments, the commandments that were handed down by God at the creation of mankind, the Ten Commandments that were later chiseled in stone on Mount Sinai, and then carried around as a constant reminder by the children of Israel in what was called the Ark of the Covenant. The Ten Commandments are clearly listed in Exodus 20 and Deuteronomy 5 and sprinkled throughout the rest of the Bible. In fact, it's foundational. What a remarkable world we would live in if everyone kept just one of the Ten Commandments. How it would change our lives. But then some people willingly disregard the laws of God, and they knowingly or unknowingly embrace Satan the adversary in the coming of the future beast power of the end time. Paul wrote to the church in Thessalonica in 2 Thessalonians 2, In 2 Thessalonians 2, we're going to look at verses 8 through 12. Because you see, what we're looking at is those who want a certain amount of rules to establish civilization. But, as they say, the devil is in the details. What kind of rules are we going to have? Are we going to have rules that everybody lives by, or is it rules for thee, but not for me, when it comes to the rulers? So 2 Thessalonians 2, verses 8 through 12. And then the lawless one will be revealed, whom the Lord will consume with the breath of his mouth and destroy with the brightness of his coming. The coming of the lawless one is according to the working of Satan with all power, signs, and lying wonders, and with all unrighteous deception among those who perish, because they did not receive the love of the truth, that they might be saved. And for this reason, God will send them strong delusion, that they should believe the lie, that they may all be condemned who did not believe the truth, but had pleasure in unrighteousness. So the lawless one, meaning those inspired by Satan, threw over the law. They threw over the potential for mankind to live in harmony, to live in peace, to subscribe to the rules of civilization, so we can all get along. And here, Paul is writing that it's important for us to avoid being susceptible to strong delusion so we don't read a lie. We read earlier in Proverbs 15:14, it's our own personal responsibility to seek the truth, to seek knowledge, to seek understanding, so we're not susceptible to lies. In Proverbs 15:14, the heart of him who has understanding seeks knowledge, but the mouth of the fools feeds on foolishness. Now, recognizing that there's a certain amount of laws of society, in order for us to all get along and society doesn't melt down into a barbarian situation, we know that there are people who claim to be Christians, but then they openly disregard God's laws. The Merriam-Webster Dictionary defines these people as antinomians. They don't believe in keeping God's law. So you look at Merriam-Webster, it says, one who holds that under the gospel of dispensation, the moral law is of no use or obligation because faith alone is necessary for salvation. So they're just imagining that everybody will be fine. We don't need the law to help us out. Well, how does that turn out in the world? And we see a lot of disasters in every direction that we look when people disregard the law of God. Well, if we hold to the laws of God, then what happens when mankind arrogates the power himself, the power of God? Well, we should follow God, therefore we should follow me because I'm following God kind of approach. So I'll make the rules and you'll all be better off. Now just put yourself back in the high school student position. Well, throughout the ages and till the last several hundred years, rulers embraced the idea that they ruled over other people by divine right. And the idea of divine right is that God put the ruler in power, therefore anything that ruler must do, it has to be God ordained, because after all, they're in power. There's a famous remark, or an infamous remark, attributed to an absolutist monarch. Absolutist means that king says, whatever I say is the law, and if you object, you're subject to the death penalty. Well, there was an absolutist monarch, King Louis XVI, and he was the last French king before the French Revolution. And paraphrased in English, he said, or it's claimed he said, I am the law. Actually, it comes across as, I am the state. Whatever I say is the law approach. And so whatever he came out of his mouth was the law, even if it contradicted some other law was against people's well-being. You probably heard of King Louis XVI. Happened to be the husband of Marie Antoinette. Not surprisingly, the people had an uprising there, and both the king and the queen were beheaded. The children of Israel didn't always have kings to govern over them. God expected everyone individually to obey God's laws. And then God appointed judges to decide in matters of dispute. We'll turn to 1 Samuel 8 in a moment. For 400 years, Israel was ruled by judges who decided disputes. You know, hey, wait a minute. Is the property line here or is it there? Did somebody move the marker? What about a dispute in a transaction? There were disputes that came up, misunderstandings along, and so there were judges. And then there were judges that raised up defenses for the nation when they were attacked by other nations. Well, but the ruling by judges who were raised up by God, that wasn't good enough for the children of Israel. They saw flaws in the character of the judges, and they decided that having a king was a better idea. Indeed, in fact, if we go back to Deuteronomy 17, it was prophesied that Israel would want a king. This was in the wilderness. When they came into the promised land, it was prophesied that you're going to want a king. And when you do, you need to read this part of the law where it says, here's the responsibilities of a king. Well, let's turn to 1 Samuel 4 or 8, starting in verse 4. And we come to this story about the elders of Israel, 1 Samuel 8 and verse 4. They wanted to throw off the system of the judges. They saw the human characters or the flaws, said, we can do better than this. We'll just do like all the other countries do. We'll have a king. Yay. And then we'll be normal. Verse 4. And then all the elders of Israel gathered together, came to Samuel at Ramah and said, look, you are old. Your sons don't walk in your ways. Now make us a king to judge us like all the nations. Verse 6. But the thing displeased Samuel, and they said, give us a king to judge us. So Samuel prayed to the Lord. And the Lord said to Samuel, heed the voice of the people in all that they say to you, for they've not rejected you, but they have rejected me, that I should not reign over them. What was God's expectation? It was that they should control their own behavior, that they should be responsible directly and individually to God, and they would come together if there was a conflict, and the judges would resolve that. Verse 8, according to all the works which they have done since the day I brought them out of Egypt, even to this day, with which they have forsaken me and served other gods, they are doing to you also. So they abandoned the true God, absorbed some of the local customs, and now they're trying to throw over the prophet that God had sent. Verse 9, now therefore, heed their voice. Give them what they want. As the saying goes, give enough rope and they'll hang themselves. Well, this is what we're reading right here. Therefore, heed their voice. However, you shall solemnly forewarn them and show them the behavior of the king who will reign over them. So what did these children of Israel want? They wanted civilization their way. They wanted to do it without the Ten Commandments. They wanted to do it without the expectations of God. We'll just have a king, and then he can rule over us. He can do it. Verse 10, so Samuel told all the words of the Lord to the people who asked him for a king. And he said, this will be the behavior of a king who will reign over you. Now we have the list, and it's an unpleasant list. He, meaning the new king, will take your sons and daughters and appoint him for his own chariots and to be his horsemen. Some will run before his chariots. In other words, announcing his presence. Think of press secretary. He will appoint captains over his thousands and captains over his fifties. He will set some to plow his ground and reap his harvest. Some to make his weapons of war and equipment for his chariots. He will take your daughters to be perfumers, cooks, and bakers. He will take the best of your fields, your vineyards, your olive groves, and give them to his servants. Ooh, favoritism. Helping out people that scratched his back, and he rewarded them. He will take your male servants, your female servants, your finest young men, your donkeys, and put them to his work. He will take a tenth of your sheep, and you will be his servants. Well, we'd be happy if they only took a tenth nowadays, right? You live in New York City, it exceeds 50%. Sorry for those who might be watching in New York City. And you will cry out in that day because of your king whom you've chosen for yourselves, and the Lord will not hear you in that day. Because why? You've chosen the path, he's telling them. That's the decision that you wanted. Well, the idea of having laws for an orderly society is not bad or wrong. The problem is when the rulers make laws burdensome to the people. The problem is when rulers take for themselves the wealth of the people, just as we read in 1 Samuel 8. The kings then arrogated power and wealth to themselves. And even today, many rulers make laws to protect their friends and line their pockets with riches taxed from others. We can just see who sponsors the big television programs, for example, and who pays for the ads as to what who's really pushing an agenda. It's on the other hand, understanding that civilization versus barbarity, without laws, a community or a nation would descend into chaos and barbarity. And there's a certain amount of organization and codes that are necessary for the operation of a civil society. So we look around. We have driver's licenses and laws outlining how to resolve disputes in the courts of law. The challenge becomes when civil laws are so restrictive as to make people chafe under the leadership of the rulers. Jesus Christ had something to say to his disciples about being a ruler. In Matthew 20, Now, this was after a couple of disciples had asked if they could rule with Jesus Christ on his right and his left hand. And what did Christ respond in verse 24? Matthew 20, verse 24. And when the 10 heard it, they were greatly displeased with the two brothers. Two of them wanted to be rulers over the rest. So they were a little chafing. But to verse 25, but Jesus called to them to himself and said, "You know the rulers of the Gentiles lord it over them, and those who exercise, and those who are great exercise authority over them. Yet it shall not be so among you, but whoever desires to become great among you, let him be your servant." Boom. Jesus Christ explained how to be a great person was to be a servant to others, not to lord it over with authority over others. We look back in Matthew 15:19. In 15:19, Matthew 15:9. What did Jesus say? And he's speaking here of the Pharisees, who he had just called in verse 9, 7. He called them hypocrites, said they honored God with their lips, but their hearts were far from him. And then in verse 9, what did Jesus say about those Pharisees who had lots of rules for everybody to live by? "In vain they worship me, teaching for doctrines the commandments of men." So they wanted to make sure that everything was done right and orderly, but they went far beyond the laws of God. So there's one way of looking at the world, and that is civilization versus barbarity. And so fundamentally, we've got to have a certain amount of rule of law and civilization, because if we don't, society will melt down. On the other hand, we got to be cautious that it doesn't get overdone. The third language or methodology of looking at everything in the world is this mindset sees the oppressed versus the oppressor. The oppressed versus the oppressor. Well, this mindset sees most of the world as oppressed. And because there are people who are oppressed, someone else must be to blame for their oppressor. Someone else has to be the oppressor. So therefore, they constantly look to the victims, who they call victims, and then blame someone else for the other people's problems. This is a problem, because that means now we have everyone is capable of being a victim of something, but we don't have to remain victims. We don't have to stay victims in our own mind. And yet it's important for people in this mindset to always assign the position of oppressed versus the oppressor. The problem comes about with, if everybody's oppressed, which one is more oppressed than the next one? So this mindset, then, we call this intersectionality. Well, if you're a woman, you have always been oppressed by men. Therefore, you have special treatment. But if you're a transgendered person pretending to be a woman, you're even more important than a woman. So that maybe is a higher value to those people, because those are even more oppressed. Well, what if you're a believer in a religion that sacrifices other human beings? Well, that's clearly against God's law, and yet there aren't very many of those, so they're a severe minority. So we have to respect them, even though they're killing their babies before they're born, because those people are oppressed. Somebody else is telling them what to do. And so we have this constant approach of, when they're looking through the keyhole at the door of life, and they peek through the keyhole, all they see is oppressed people. And therefore, someone else is the oppressor. Well, we've taken a look earlier at the statement, and I'm going to page through it in just a moment. The reason Christ came was in Luke 14, verse 18. Jesus Christ said that he has appointed me to preach the gospel to the poor, heal the brokenhearted, proclaim liberty to the captives, recover sight to the blind, and set at liberty those who are oppressed. So there's their justification. Everybody's oppressed, so Jesus Christ gives us the authority now to assign an oppressor for everyone else. What's the problem with that? Everybody begins then to become oppressed in some way, and therefore society becomes divided. And we have a satanic ruse or that will cause division throughout society, because one oppressed group will be more important than the next oppressed group, which is more important than the next one, and everybody they don't like is their oppressor. So you have the people who are who are poor will say the rich are oppressing me, and yet Christ said the rich you will or the poor you will always have always, but you won't have me. Won't have me always. In fact, you take a look at Judas Iscariot, and when Mary and I. Apparently, I'm missing that page of notes, when Mary was proposed to anoint Christ's feet with an expensive oil, what did Judas Iscariot say? Now, he was the treasurer for the disciples, and he said, wait a minute, shouldn't we take that expensive perfumed oil and sell it for 300 denarii and give it to the poor? After all, that's what we're supposed to help them out doing. Okay? Christ cut through that. Jesus cut through that in a hurry and said, you will always have the poor with you. You will always have people who make decisions that result, whether it's by their choice or by the system under which they live. You will always have them there, but you won't always have me there. So while it's important to take care of the poor, as we've heard in today's sermonette, that's a responsibility of true religion. That is an individual responsibility. And not one that we can delegate to others, that we can say, well, I'm going to outsource the coercion to the government, so the government can now take money from you and give it to you, or take it from you and give it to you, and so forth and on around. So there, now we have a conflict between the languages of people who instinctively think in one of these three ways. So what are those three ways? We have the way of looking at freedom versus coercion. We want to make our own decisions, or do we want somebody else to make those decisions for us? And most of us want to make our own decisions, but we don't mind making the decisions for other people, because after all, we know best. So that we would call that liberty versus coercion. And we can point to the scripture on that one that backs that up. Then we have civilization versus barbarity. Now, by the way, the first group we commonly call those libertarians in that description. Then we have civilization versus barbarity, where we have this code of thinking that there's a certain amount of law that comes with civilization. We still want freedom, but, you know, we've got driver's licenses and some speed limits and so forth that put some limits on people. Although I got to say that putting a 25-mile-an-hour speed limit sign that's covered by trees coming out of a 45-mile-an-hour speed limit sign, and the trees are never trimmed, even though the city owns the area, I find that interesting. But that was 25 years ago, and it cost me $109. And I'm sure that I'm going to forget that at some point as the memory fades off into the distance. On my way to church, no less. I remember that spot now, and I know where that one is. But there is a certain amount of orderliness. Nobody wants, I saw a meme on the internet that showed a speed sign, you know, that was announcing the traveler's speed. And, you know, and so it would flash up there. And then next to it was a 25 mile an hour speed limit sign. Somebody made their own sign that posted up next to it and says, the record so far is 58 miles an hour. So somebody was zinging through. And so they have there's a good reason, and that is for safety. I understand that. So there's a certain amount of organization in society, but then there is a limit because sometimes people take it to themselves to say, well, we can save the world from being barbarous by overdosing them on the rules. So the second category is civilization versus barbarity. And they're commonly called conservatives. We want to generally have some rules, but we don't want to have too many. And then the third category is the oppressed versus the oppressor. And we instinctively look at that and saying the world is full of oppressed people, and therefore there's somebody must be oppressing them. And so we will call, and those are generally called progressives, so that they will see the world in those terms. And whether we like it or not, we instinctively gravitate to one of those three mindsets or languages, as it will. Whether it's a Swahili, Urdu, or Romansh, whatever language it is, and we're not likely to really see the other one just as those people that speak those other languages. Kind of see those. So it helps if we understand that and recognize that they all point to what they think is the biblical backup. And that's why I had the sermonette played today, because who's commonly oppressed? True religion is this in James 1, you know, is to take care of the widows and the orphan. Okay, that's an individual responsibility that each one of us have to do that. So we can each step up to that. So the oppressed versus oppressor, commonly called the progressives. So what language do you speak? And let's be aware that others will speak various languages. That's their instinct. Beware of that. And it's important for us to understand and speak what God teaches and do things in a manner that would be befitting for Him.